But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, and even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they are grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me."
Good morning. I am astounded constantly by the workings of God, especially in Scripture. Some of you, I think, know, I say it from time to time, that when I work out sermon plans, I preach from a three-year calendar of sermon texts that I then write sermons based on the assigned text. I pick a year in advance kind of what I intend to preach on a given Sunday. I'm currently working on the 2019 series of sermons. I'm as far as February. If you have a request for March, this is the time to tell me. I've got as far as February planning out sermons and material. And yet, having done it in that way, it never ceases to amaze me that you can take a 3,000-year-old story planned a year in advance and fling those ancient words on the screen, and they will speak to what happened Thursday morning and in the lives of people in your room. And it happens every week, that God simply has something to say every Sunday morning. And I don't have to work that hard to do it. That if I let Him talk and get out of the way, He has a lot to say to us. And that never ceases to amaze me. We're going to take a few weeks in the book of Ruth, and follow it up with one lesson from 1 Samuel. But we're going to look at three women characters in the Old Testament that I find especially helpful because of some of the experiences they go through and some of the characteristics that they teach us. The first of these is Naomi, whom I've titled this morning Naomi the Bitter. Now let me just say a word about Naomi before I even go any further. My goal this morning is not to vilify Naomi. Naomi is not a bad person. I think we're going to learn from how Naomi interacts with her story and the events of her life, and we're going to see that she learns the way she was going about some things were not healthy and helpful. But she's not a villain. She is a wife who has lost her husband and a mother who has lost two sons in the course of a decade and is in a foreign land in the ancient world that didn't spend a lot of time making sure widow women were taken care of. You can understand every ounce of bitterness and grief that she experiences and sympathize with it. Today, we're going to try to learn from it. But it's not because she's a villain. It's because she's a lot like us. There are healthy and unhealthy ways to grieve in difficult experiences. And this morning, we're going to take a look at some things that Naomi demonstrates, which I think are, we're going to find are very unhealthy for us. They're not helpful. And maybe we'll learn something from it, from Naomi the Bitter. To give you a bird's eye view of the book of Ruth so that you've got a framework to set this into, we're mostly going to be in chapter 1 this morning, but just to kind of give you the whole story, Ruth is just this beautiful little four-chapter story in the Old Testament before the age of kings and David and heroes and so forth, of people living in the land doing their thing. And the story starts out with a man and his wife and his sons that go off into the land of Moab. There was a time of hardship and famine. And so looking for maybe a little help and relief, they meander off into Moab. It was a place God had told them not to go, right? If you read the Old Testament, don't go to Moab. It's a bad idea. We don't know why exactly, what rationale, but they end up over there. And while they're there, Naomi's sons do what every Jewish woman wants her sons to do, which is bring home Gentile wives. No, no. Right, this is a nightmare scenario. It's the worst case scenario. We move to Moab, and guess who they marry? They bring home Moabite women as their wives, and they live in this land. And so already you can imagine Naomi is a wee bit on edge about how things are playing out in her life. And then her husband dies in this foreign land. But that's okay, because I've got two sons, and we're here, and we've got family. And then in the coming years, her two sons die. And so at the end of that, in the story we're going to read today, Naomi decides that it only makes sense for her, there is no future for her in the place she's at. And it only makes sense to go back home. But it doesn't make any sense for these daughters-in-law to come with her. They have no future in Judah. And so she says to them, stay put, I'm going. One of them, Orpah, by the way, side note, at some point in this sermon, I am going to say Oprah instead of Orpah. I think there's even a slide where I have a typo. It's just I do it every time, and I'm sorry. I know her name is Orpah, for what it's worth. Orpah decides that that is the most sensible solution and stays in Moab. But Ruth decides not to. Next week, we want to talk about Ruth and why she makes that decision. But for now, we just need to know that she did. And she decides to go back to, or well, not back to, for Naomi, it's going back home. For Ruth, it's going to a strange new land, this land of Judea. In the story that follows, events take place that no one could have imagined. They meet this man named named Boaz while working in his field, and it turns out he's exactly the guy who has the appropriate claim to the heritage of Ruth and Naomi, and events transpire, there's a little bit of romance, something happens on the threshing floor, we'll talk about that next week, we've got to figure out what happens in chapter 3, and the long and the short of it is that Ruth and Boaz end up married, and they have children. And Naomi goes from being absolutely isolated and alone and hopeless to being a very proud grandmother at the end of the story, bouncing little baby Obed on her knee and excited. The story ends even more so by saying, oh, and by the way, wait a few generations. This is the lineage of King David. And it becomes a blessing to all of Israel's story. Okay, so that's Ruth in a nutshell. Today, I just want to look at the beginning of that story and try to understand what we can learn from Naomi in the first part of it. When she has this experience in the first 6 verses of terrible grief and loss, I say terrible knowing that many of you can identify with that grief and loss through the loss of loved ones in your own life, that this is, it's terrible and yet it's all too common that we know what grief looks like. Her first response is an attempt at isolation. When you are grieving, there is this human tendency to want to close in on ourselves and hold everyone else at arm's length. Look in Ruth chapter 1, verses 8 and 9. Naomi said to her 2 daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. There is nobody on the face of the earth that understands what Naomi is going through more than Ruth and Oprah. See, there's Oprah right there on the screen. I did it. I knew I would do it. Orpah, Ruth, and the others. Fortunately, she's not important to the story, so I don't have to say it a lot. But it's Ruth and Orpah. There's no one who understands what she's going through more than those 2 people. And yet, what is her knee-jerk reaction? To push them away. She even comes up with a rationalization for it. It sounds like kindness. Hey, there's no practical hope and future for you back among my people, so why don't you just stay here? But as the text unfolds, it becomes clear to me, at least, that wasn't actually her motivation. She's not doing this out of kindness. Kindness is an excuse to isolate herself in her grief. When you are grieving, you want to go in a closet and hide, and you don't want to see anybody else, especially the people that can help you the most. And I don't know, I'm not a psychologist, I don't know exactly what it is about us that makes us do that, but I know we do. She has an edge to her grief that has taken the form of bitterness. Grief is a perfectly legitimate human emotion that we all need to learn to experience. Bitterness is a poison that contaminates grief and makes it something it should not be. Grief can be shared with other people. Bitterness is something we only have for ourselves. Naomi has bitterness. And she wants other people out of her life. Can we understand why? We can. Folks, every time she sees Ruth, she remembers her son. You understand why she wants as much distance from that part of her story as possible. You understand it, but what I'm here to tell you is it's not helpful. Do you understand that as beautiful as the story of Ruth turns out to be, none of it happens if Naomi is allowed to isolate herself in the way that she wants? It only happens because somebody stubbornly, in their own grief, says, "No, I'm not going to give you your way. You and I are going together." In fact, and I'll talk about this more next week, there's a funny thing that happens. It's a sad story, so you have to stop anytime there's something funny and laugh about it to help yourself get through it. In the next couple of verses, Ruth says, "No, no, no, I'm going with you." And she says, "Where you lodge, I will lodge." What's interesting is about in the Hebrew, the word for lodge is also the word for complain. So you could also read that, hey, you're going to be angry here and you're going to be angry there. Wherever you go to complain is where I'll go to complain. It's kind of a sassy thing to say. It's kind of funny. It's a way of saying, listen, you're going to be miserable here and you're going to be miserable there. We're going to be miserable together. Wherever you end up is where I'm going to end up, and we're just going to be miserable together because you can't get rid of me. It is a wonderful, if sarcastic, sentiment. It's exactly what I want every Christian to do to people that are grieving. You don't get to be miserable without me. We're going to be miserable together. And it turns out that is a source of strength and blessing that could not have happened any other way. Disguised as kindness, Naomi is acting out of grief and anger. And she almost misses out on the most beautiful thing God had ever put in her life because of the choice to isolate. So point number one I want to make, when you're experiencing grief, do not isolate yourself from the people who want to be a comfort. Are they always good comforters? No. Sometimes people are really bad at comforting you. Let me just say that. It happens a lot. Some people try to comfort you and make it worse. I apologize on their behalf. Sometimes it's me. But the only worst thing you can do is simply to isolate yourself from everyone who is trying to help you grieve and to grieve with you. You need those people. Those are the people God has put there to help you through this season of grief. Do not isolate yourself from them. Another thing that happens in the life of Naomi is she reveals to us a deep and abiding sense of hopelessness. In verses 10 through 13, they said to her, these are the two daughters, they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they have become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. And if I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait until they are grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter for me, for your sake, that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." In her suffering, and you, if you read that carefully, it's worded in a very sharp way, right? She could have just said, "I don't have any hope for you." What she says is, "Do I have any more boys for you?" Right? I mean, that is a sharp thing to say for someone who is grieving. You understand it because she's grieving, but it's not a healthy kind of grief. She's taking it out on two women who are also grieving. We'll talk about that in the next slide. But the other comment I want to make about that is that she believes in her grief that nothing good will ever happen again. In her life, she has kind of assessed and measured the good things in her life. I have a husband. I have two sons. On this day, she has no husband. She has no sons. And she believes nothing good can ever happen to her again. There is a difference between grief and despair. Grief is the legitimate mourning of something good that has been lost. Despair is when we decide that nothing good can ever happen again. One of those is healthy. One of those is not. I'm going to say this, and I mean it with all the love in the world. It turns out God is more clever than we are. When we look at the future, we can only imagine certain ways that life could be better. Listen to what Naomi says. Am I going to get married again? I'm an old woman. I'm going to have sons. She can imagine one or two scenarios equally outlandish. And in her mind, there is simply no possibility that anything good can happen, mostly because she herself cannot imagine it. My beloved brethren, God is more imaginative than you are. On the day of the death of Jesus Christ, people looked and they could not imagine anything good coming from that. And Sunday morning, the unimaginable happened. God does good things you didn't see coming, and He does it all the time. And so the difference between a Christian grief and a faithless grief, and I say that with all kindness, not to insult grief. Grief is a shared experience and a terrible thing. But the difference between a healthy and an unhealthy grief is that the Christian holds out this hope. Even though I have no idea how it could get better, I believe God's way smarter than me. And I believe He's actually out to do something good in this world. And maybe if I wait and pray, even through gritted teeth, God will bring about something better than I could have imagined. If you'll stay tuned to the end of the sermon, that's exactly what happens in the life of Naomi. Exactly what she said was impossible is what happens. But it happens in a way that never could have been imagined. Because God has bigger plans than we could have guessed. And we need to remember the difference between grief and hopelessness. When I don't do a lot of counseling. When I do counseling, there are a few words I don't allow. And one of those words are never and always. Like, you can tell me anything. In counseling, you just do a lot of listening. You just say, okay, tell me what you think. And I don't interrupt people and say, how dare you feel that way, right? I mean, it's your feelings. You feel the way you feel. And I'm kind of here to listen to you. Only time I interrupt people and say, nope, is when they say always and never. When they say, it'll always be this way. It's never been any good. It'll never be. And I say, big words. Always, never. There's only one person who ever gets to say always and never, and it's not me. God gets to say always and never. The rest of us get to hope because things happen that I couldn't have imagined. Things do get better in the worst possible scenarios. A third thing I'd learn from Naomi is back to our title word, and it's the word bitterness. And verse 13. Verse 13, at the end of that, it says, "Know, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Naomi's grief has morphed into the poison of bitterness. And it is the root of all the problems we're discussing today. Bitterness will not allow you to see anything good. Bitterness will not allow you to see anything hopeful. Bitterness is not sadness. Bitterness is anger. Sadness is, I don't know why it's this way. Bitterness says, I know exactly why it's this way, and I'm not happy with him. And that's how she says it. The hand of the Lord is out against me. She's not sad that the world is chaotic and confusing and depressing. She is angry that God has singled her out in the universe for suffering. See the difference in those two? One is grief, one is bitterness. And we have to be very cautious about the poison of bitterness. Bitterness makes you think that you are suffering uniquely. The New Revised Standard Version here, I think, actually has a better translation of the last part of that sentence than most of our translations give us. Because I don't believe what Naomi says there in the text is, I'm very, very bitter. I think what she says, true to the text, is, it has been far more bitter for me than for you. Now, it may be a subtle difference. It's one thing to say, I've had a really bad time of it. But Naomi goes a step further, and she says, it's been worse for me than for you. We tend to do this in our grief. We tend to compare our grief and suffering to other people. Can I start by telling you that that is an impossible task? There is no calculus available for grief and suffering. You can't compare 10 units of grief to 12 units of suffering and say, I've got more, so I deserve the right to grieve and you don't. Naomi thinks, well, it was my husband and my sons, and so it's been worse for me. Ruth lost a father figure, a brother figure, and a husband. So go ahead, tell me, what's the math on that? Which one gets more grief? That's not really possible. It's not legitimate to compare grief. If one person loses three of their children and one loses one of their children, which one is more reasonably grieving? Folks, I got news for you. They're both grieving. Grief is just grief. You don't get a chance to compare it and say there's 20 ounces of grief over there. You're not supposed to compare your situation to everybody else and say, I've got it really bad. You should really feel sorry for me. Instead, the appropriate way to grieve is simply to share that grief and to know that other people also have grief. We assume that nobody feels the way I feel. People do. No, nobody feels exactly like you. Okay, fair enough. You're you, and no one on the face of the earth is exactly like you. But we're all human, and all of us experience loss in different ways. And rather than trying to compare it and win the battle of who is suffering the most, the better solution is to say, you and I are in the same boat. How much better would this story be if Naomi can look at her daughters and instead of saying, I've got it way worse than you, she puts her arms around them and won't let go. Folks, that's a better story if it had been told that way. But Naomi gets caught in bitterness and isolation and the decision that her grief is worse than anybody's has ever been. The last point I'd make about this particular grieving of Naomi is that she believes she is utterly and completely without God. She hinted at this first way back in verse 8 when she says to the daughters, may the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. Now notice how she said that. It's subtle. She doesn't say, may God bless us. God bless us, everyone. She doesn't say that. She says, well, I hope God has a blessing for you. What does Naomi believe? God is done blessing her. And then in case you weren't sure that's what she meant, that's exactly what she says. In verse 13, the hand of the Lord has gone out against me. When we grieve, there is a tendency to believe that suddenly we are in this epic contest at the center of the universe, that God has picked on us and we are in a battle with God. Now, to be clear, we've read the book of Job for 4 weeks, and so I'm not suggesting to you have to let God off the hook. He is the creator of the universe. He is in some way responsible for what happens in his universe, and you can pray to him and talk to him, and Job has taught us that. But there is a danger in deciding that you alone are the victim in the universe and God has become your adversary. It's very different to pray to God and say, I'm not sure what's going on down here, as opposed to praying to God and say, what do you think you're doing? You're out to get me. This will be the hardest thing I'll tell you today, but in the worst moments of your grief, it is essential that you believe that God is not picking on you. The creator of the universe did not make this universe and put you in it with the intent of making you miserable. He did not create the universe as an experiment to see how much he could pick on you before you broke. You are not alone. Whatever is happening in this world, with its sickness, with its sin, and its death, is happening to all of us. And I am convinced by the story of Jesus of Nazareth that God is working to make it right. That has to be my bedrock at the end of the day. I don't understand it. I don't understand why he doesn't fix it today, right? I'd be perfectly happy. I won't even finish my sermon. He can rip the top of the roof open and fix everything and we can all go home and everybody be happy. I don't know why it doesn't happen that way today. But I also don't believe that he's picking on me. And I also don't believe he's picking on you. I don't believe he is our enemy. I believe he has proven to us time and time and time and time again that he loves us, that he cares for us, and in his Son, Jesus Christ, he is working to make all things new. I've got to have that. The cold, dark universe won't give that to me, but my God will. And the difference between grief and bitterness sometimes is just that decision. The willingness to say, I don't think God is my enemy. Am I thrilled with him? Not at the exact moment. But he's not out to get me. What is he doing? I don't know. But God remains good. Final thing then I'll say about Naomi. We've learned four lessons, I hope, about how to grieve. We've learned about the poison of bitterness, the danger of isolation. We've learned about don't assume that God is out to get you. We've learned about the danger of hopelessness. The last thing I want to say to you is difficult to hear, but if you'll stick with me, it's important. Despair, and the reason you need to choose grief but not despair, is that despair is a lie. In sadness, we have a tendency to believe that lie more than any other time in our lives. Naomi believes that she will always be alone. Naomi believes that God is out to get her. Naomi believes that she has no future, that she has lost everything, and if one thing is clear, she'll never have a son again. To her, that is the bedrock reality of her new existence, and she's mad about it. Not a sentence on that screen is true. Every word of it is a lie told by grief and believed in bitterness. If you'll flip over for our last passage in Ruth chapter 4, the story ends, and piece by piece, the story of God in her life reverses everything she believed to be true. In Ruth chapter 4 and verse 13, we read these words. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception, and she bore a son. Naomi's not alone. At the end of the story, she has a family again. Like Job, it's not the family she lost. It's not a one-to-one, apples-to-apples replacement that suddenly makes everything bad undone. But she's not alone at the end of this story. She would have been if she had her way. She tried to isolate herself. But because Ruth hugged her around the neck and wouldn't let her go, she has family, more family than she ever could have guessed possible. Not only that, in verse 14, she finds out that God isn't out to get her. God is out to bless her. In verse 14, then the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer, and may his name be renowned in Israel. The women come around and tell Naomi the one thing that she could not believe. Look how God has blessed you today. It's the opposite of what she believed. She believed she had an enemy in the universe who was out to see how much he could make her suffer. The story ends by telling us that God was there and had never left and was working each and every day through that grief to bless her in ways unimaginable. She believed she had no future. In fact, her future was bright. In verse 15, he shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. Not only are you not going to move off and be on your own and be miserable for the end of your days, you have a future you never could have imagined. God has never left you. Your future is bright. She thought she had lost everything, but instead what she had was someone important she was overlooking. And again, leave it to the women of Israel to tell us this. They say at the end of verse 15, you have someone for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. Naomi saw her whole world in three men, her husband and her two sons that were lost to her. She looked at Ruth and saw nothing. That's the sadness of bitterness. That someone who should have been the most important person in her life, she couldn't see any value in Ruth and was happy to send her away. At the end of the story, You had someone all along who was better than seven sons. You had someone who was making your life better, and you were ready to get rid of her. You had everything. You just didn't know it. But more than that, the absolute impossible ending, the most poignant scene of the story to my eyes, even more so than the romance of Ruth and Boaz, which is itself magnificent, is the final scene of Naomi in verse 16. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. There was one thing she was absolutely certain of in chapter 1. I will have no sons. And there he is. She's holding a little baby in her lap. Little baby Obed right there in her lap. And what do the women say? And the women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. God's hopefulness, God's power to bring about what you could not believe possible, is easily doubted but never untrue. He can do exceedingly more than we can ask or think. Your job is not to anticipate it. Naomi, I don't hold Naomi accountable and say, well, you should have seen this coming. Nobody should have seen this coming. All that we ask of you and all that we ask of Naomi is that you believe it's possible that a good God could do more than we could have guessed. And that possibility has to be enough. And then we wait. We wait and we don't know how long. We wait and we don't even know for what. But we wait. And they that wait upon the Lord will renew their strengths. And they will mount up on wings like eagles. They will run and not be weary. They will fight and not shrink. Help us, Lord, to wait. If you've been waiting on the Lord and need the prayers of your brethren, if you would turn to God in faith and wait for his salvation, our invitation, as always, stands open. We're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. Won't you come?